This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Primary season is over, but the election season has just begun. This week, voters made their selections for Republican and Democratic candidates for the fall campaign. Yes, the top of the ticket presents a sharp contrast of ideology between Republican Ron DeSantis and Democrat Andrew Gillum. We'll talk more about that race next hour here on WLRN. There are clear-cut differences in South Florida races as the candidates compete for the hundreds of thousands of voters here who are not registered Republicans or Democrats. How could the candidates for governor influence the local congressional races here? How will the president impact local campaign efforts to attract voters in the middle, the purple voters? And if you voted, but your neighbor and coworker or friend didn't, how would you convince them to cast their ballot this fall? Join us now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN.
This is Melina Fortunato from Miami, Florida. I would tell someone who didn't vote that taking the time to vote is one of the thousands of small choices we make during a day. But combined with like-minded voters, these small choices can actually lead to true representation. And sometimes, if we're lucky, even the opportunity to make history.
Hi, my name is Christian Flores. I live in Davie, Florida. In order for me to vote, I will need to vote online. That is the most convenient thing to do. And basically, everything can be done online except voting. That is ridiculous.
My name is Cordelia. I live in Lake Worth, Florida. I would say that our African-American ancestors died without the right to vote. The least we can do is honor them by voting.
About 30% of registered voters in Florida turned out for the primary vote between mail-in voting, early voting, and primary day on Tuesday. So how would you convince that other 70% of voters to get engaged during the fall campaign? 800-743-WLRN. Who'd you vote for and why in the local elections? 800-743-9576. Daniel Rivero is WLRN's reporter covering a number of different things, including the fight for the 27th congressional seat here in Florida, an open seat being vacated by Ileana Ross-Layton. And Dan Sweeney is a political reporter for the Sun Sentinel with us via Skype. Danny, let me start with you. Set up the race in the 27th as it now stands after primary day.
So right now, this is a race that's really between two centrist candidates. You have Ileana Ross-Layton retiring, and she's, of course, a longtime congresswoman, very popular in the district with both Republicans and Democrats, a rare commodity nowadays.
Yeah.
And she's leaving office, and the Republican who got the nomination is former Spanish language journalist Maria Elvira Salazar, mm-hmm. Who is basically trying to pick up where Ileana left off. And on the Democratic side, you have former Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services under the Clinton administration, Donna Shalala. She was also the president of the University of Miami for many years. So, and she's basically an establishment Democrat, pretty much a centrist. So you have two people in the middle.
This is a stark contrast compared to the wings of the party that are represented by the gubernatorial candidates that Republicans and Democrats chose, DeSantis on the right and Gillum on the left. Here in the 27th, an open congressional seat that both Republicans and Democrats are trying to vie for. Republicans obviously want to retain control of the House of Representatives. Democrats would like a run after control of the House of Representatives. This is one of the seats it thinks it can pick up. But you're seeing centrist type candidates in the 27th, not the ideological big split we're seeing at the top of the ticket.
That's exactly right. And in many ways, that's a reflection of the district itself. This is, by most measures, a centrist district. Hillary Clinton won the district by a large margin, but also Ileana Ross-Layton won in that election. So this is the people that live here are comfortable splitting the ticket.
Dan Sweeney, what's at stake for the Florida delegation with this race in the 27th before we talk about some of those Broward County congressional races?
Well, obviously, this is maybe their major pickup, the Democrats, their major chance for a pickup in the Florida delegation. And they've got candidates running in against both of the other Republican congressmen in Miami-Dade as well. And one of them, Carlos Curbelo, is in a Democratic-leaning district, so I think they're kind of hoping to make a few gains in Miami-Dade.
And what about the appeal for the swing voter that exists in this congressional district in the 27th, in Curbelo's district in the 26th, which Dan Sweeney, you mentioned, kind of has leaned Democratic for a long time, but Curbelo, a Republican, running for re-election. But also those swing voters in Broward County, where Democrats have dominated the congressional space. But in some cases, it's been in the low 50% range. So some could say, you know, it's a 3 or 4 or 5 point swing could make a difference in some of these districts.
Sure. And, you know, in the congressman who represents most of Broward County and a little bit of Palm Beach is Representative Ted Deutsch. His district, when you look at how it's voted in presidential elections, is about the same as Carlos Curbelo's district. So theoretically, the right Republican could possibly pick that up. But, they're not really running these sort of Curbelo model, you know, centrist Republican who's, you know, fighting climate change and doing some other things that Democrats really want to hear about. It was a pretty contentious primary. Nicholas Kamaz won it. And just like in the 23rd, where Debbie Wasserman Schultz is facing Republican opposition, you have Republicans that are really concentrating on talking about the war on terror and radical Islam, and not really talking about the sort of issues that, you know, voters in these districts kind of seem to concentrate more on.
Why do you think that is, Dan Sweeney, that those Republican nominees in the congressional districts in Broward County, which have leaned Democratic, are not doing the bread and butter kind of local issues, but instead are, you know, they're talking about the war on terror, radical Islam, U.S.-Israeli relations?
Sure. Well, you know, Wasserman Schultz's district, unlike Ted Deutsch's, here, with the exception of a couple of majority-minority districts, Alcee Hastings and Frederica Wilson, mm-hmm. maybe one or two others, Debbie Wasserman Schultz's district is the most Democratic in the state. And yet, the Republicans will run somebody against her every year. It's mostly, I feel like, because she's a very high-profile congresswoman. She's the target of a lot of, Republican attacks. And somebody really wants to go head to head with her every 2 years, despite the fact that the numbers there, the demographics, are really not in their favor. So you get candidates that are not necessarily best to win a Democratic leaning district, but that, you know, really are hungry to go after somebody like her.
Yeah. Dan Sweeney, reporter on politics for the Sun Sentinel, with us via Skype. Danny Rivero is a reporter for us here at WLRN. Danny, what about the appeal of the swing voter in South Florida? What do you anticipate? What could these candidates in the 27th congressional district, how are they going to try to appeal for that 40% in the middle?
You know, that's a really good question. To take Salazar, for example, mm-hmm. A lot of Republicans nationwide, they're taking the approach, as and Ron DeSantis took it at the state level to get the nominee, of really latching themselves on to Trump and his support. And, you know, ABC News actually asked Salazar at her watch party, you know, would you like President Trump to come down and campaign for you?
Hmm.
And she kind of wavered. She said, you know, we'll have to think about it. So it came across in a visibly diplomatic kind of way, where she's trying not to repel possible centrists and, you know, maybe keep on some of those Republicans who do like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, she's trying to maneuver in a way where she can attract some of these centrist people. You know, Ileana Ross-Layton was very known for her work on human rights and whatnot. She's mm-hmm. trying to stay in that lane. And, you know, Donna Shalala, she's not really an Andrew Gillum kind of Democrat.
Far from it. The progressive Democrats in that race were really putting some pressure on Shalala in the race.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a little bit of a question of, you know, how is she gonna pull that together? Is she gonna have the really progressive wing of the party in that district coming in and voting for her, mm-hmm. or if they like some of what Salazar is saying as a centrist? Mm. Would they split their ticket?
Maria Elvira Salazar, the Republican nominee in the Florida 27th Congressional District. This is the race to replace the retiring Congresswoman, long-serving Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton. The Congresswoman showed up at the Republican nominees' victory party on primary night.
Ileana won by 10 points, and she's very much loved, and that's exactly what I'm planning to do. I'm going to continue her legacy, and it's going to be a seamless transition between Ileana Ross and myself, because we believe on the same causes, and we may not agree on everything, specifically on everything, but it's the same plan.
Maria Elvira Salazar, a double-digit win over her nearest opponent in the primary. Donna Shalala winning on the Democratic side, but in a much narrower victory for the former University of Miami president.
It's just the beginning. I still have to run hard because so much is at stake. The future of South Florida is at stake. And we simply have to stop the terrible policies of Washington.
So what role do national politics play in these local races in Dade County, Broward County, Palm Beach County, Monroe County? And what is it that is attracting you to get involved in politics, if that means for a specific campaign or if it just means voting, for that matter? Only 30% turnout in this primary, which was a multi-year high in the state of Florida, no doubt about it, the highest turnout we've seen in better part of a decade. But still, 70% of registered voters in Florida not casting a ballot in this primary election. What will it take to convince those to vote? 800-743-WLRN. Talking politics here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. Let's begin in Broward County, Wilton Manors. Karen is on line one. Go ahead, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi there. So the point I wanted to make, and I actually wrote down some of what you were even saying, you know, that the local press keeps referring to Andrew Gillum as this ideological, far-left candidate, and that is just not true. And I think that when the local media sensationalizes...
Now, why do you say... Let's unpack that a little bit. Did you vote for Andrew Gillum?
I did vote for Andrew Gillum.
So why do you think he's not... That characterization of Gillum is unfair or inaccurate?
Well, okay. So I consider him a mainstream progressive. First of all, he stumped for Hillary Clinton. He was almost chosen as one of her running mates, but his policies, he is not for guaranteed jobs for everybody. He is not for free college. I consider those to be the far left.
Yeah.
He's for mainstream progressive. Yeah. He wants to fund our public schools. That's mainstream. He wants common sense gun regulations.
Yeah.
That is mainstream.
It's a good point, Karen. We're going to talk more about the governor race next hour on our program as well. But I think you tapped into something interesting, which is, of course, the characterization of ideology and the lack of a scientific definition of what a Democrat and a Republican is, what a progressive Democrat is, or what a conservative Republican is.
And
right?
I think that, you know, you guys were asking, why did people not come out to vote, or why are people not going to vote?
Yeah.
Well, if you are, you know, non-party affiliated and you're somewhere in the middle and you hear your only two choices per the Sun Sentinel's editorial the other day is far left or far right, you're like, what does it matter?
Mm.
And I think that type of terminology is so hyperbolic, and it drives down voting.
Yeah.
And I was very upset with the Sun Sentinel about that. And, you know, so that to me is why some people don't vote.
Karen, really great points here. I want to get Danny and Dan to jump off that point. Dan Sweeney, what do you think? I mean, you're in the news department, not the op-ed pages here. But this characterization, it is shorthand. Maybe it's lazy on the part of us in the media to characterize this race. We know that conflict is the source of good drama, and boy, do we always want to set up politics as a battlefield. But is that kind of characterization, the kind of carving out these political lanes, turning voters off?
Well, I would say, you know, I can't speak for the opinion writers, but, you know, I have never referred to Andrew Gillum in print as far left or a socialist or any of those terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's for Medicare for all. He's for abolishing ICE and replacing it with a different agency. And these are positions that even within the Democratic Party are not necessarily universal positions. So certainly, you know, Karen said that he's, you know, a mainstream progressive. Well, the progressive position, is, you know, a position that's up for some debate even within the Democratic Party. So when you put it out across the, you know, all voters, from the farthest left Democrat to the farthest right Republican, his positions are somewhat to the left. I don't think it's controversial to say that.
Yeah.
But I've never characterized him as a far left politician.
Yeah. Danny Rivera, what about just Karen's critique of the characterization between the polarization that, some in the media do as shorthand for politics? And you talked about the centrist battle that is going to be happening in the 27th congressional district.
Well, I think Karen has somewhat of a point,
yeah.
But at the same time, I do think it is important to acknowledge that within the people who are vying for the Democratic nomination, Andrew Gillum was the most progressive, and he is on that wing of the party. He's not in the center.
How do you think that is going to influence those down ticket votes, like what we're talking about here in terms of the South Florida congressional delegation?
I mean, it could bring a lot of people out, or maybe if you perceive the election to be between an extreme in DeSantis and an extreme in Gillum, and you aren't particularly drawn to the extremes, maybe you won't show up. I mean, we really don't know. We'll have to see how that plays out.
Yeah, even though there's plenty more ballot questions in just the governor's race that are going to be on the November election. Your phone calls again here, 800-743-WLRN, talking local politics here after primary into the general election. Jovan in Kendall on line two. Go ahead. You're on the radio. Thanks for holding on.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to make a quick comment. So, like I said, I'm based out of Kendall. I'm a farmer in Homestead. So I was wondering, out of the percentage of registered voters, what percentage are independent? Because I currently am, and in a closed primary means that we can't vote no matter our level of political engagement or the likelihood of us actually voting. So I was wondering what the panel thinks about primaries with deadlines to register as Republican or Democrat being weeks before.
Yep. And I'm glad you brought that up. This gets down to the closed primary question. In other words, if you're not a registered Democrat or not a registered Republican, your ballot was pretty short on Tuesday, or your mail-in ballot. It was pretty short, Dan Sweeney. How about Jovan's question?
Well, okay. Well, first off, to the numbers, there are 3.5 million registered, no party affiliation voters in Florida, 4.6 million Republicans, and 4.8 million Democrats. That's as of book closings for this primary election. So, you know, no party voters are still a minority, but an ever-increasing one.
Yep.
And certainly, you know, the way primary elections are closed in Florida, because they're technically open unless there's more than one, as long as there's not more than one party running in November. So if you have just Democrats or just Republicans voting in the primary or running in the primary, then technically that election is open. It can only be closed when there's at least a write-in candidate or a candidate from another party. So, you know, the way it's mucked about, the way, you know, candidates will get a write-in candidate to run, to close a primary intentionally, to keep out voters outside the party.
Yeah.
You know, those sort of shenanigans play out every year. And yeah, it's those sort of things that make people say that the way we do things in Florida is a problem, not necessarily having open and closed primaries, but just the way we go about it.
Danny Rivera, about one out of every four voters, registered voters in the state of Florida, are registered with no party affiliation. That's what we've got. So 3.5 million Floridians are registered to vote, but they are not registered as a Democrat or Republican. As Dan Sweeney mentioned, it is the third largest, quote unquote, political affiliation in the state of Florida after the Democratic Party has the largest number of people, then the Republican Party, and then close behind, one out of four Floridians say we're not part of either political party.
It definitely leaves a lot to be desired when you're trying to measure the electorate and kind of make predictions on it. It's absolutely, we don't know what happened with these people when they went to the ballot box on Tuesday. What did they want?
Right.
We don't know.
Assuming that we don't know, because their votes were not part of that closed primary system that Dan Sweeney just described. 800-743-9576. What will it take to get voters back to the polls, or to the polls for that matter, in November, where all the contests will be on the ballot, not just the Republican or the Democrats? Let's go to Coral Springs, where Maria on line six. Go ahead, Maria. You're on the radio.
Hi, good afternoon. I love this topic. And what I have to say is I'm a longstanding Democrat, have always voted Democrat. But I think that in the Democratic Party, we have to stop being afraid of the word progressive. The Republicans have done a fantastic job of going more towards the right. So as Democrats, the day after Trump was elected, I was down in Miami, and there were thousands and thousands of people protesting in the march. So why are we afraid as Democrats of that word progressive and leaning a little bit more towards the left? The Republicans have done a fantastic job of it without it being demonized. But for some reason, as Democrats, we're afraid to say progressive. We're afraid to lean a little bit to the left.
Maria, I appreciate the idea. Let me put that to Dan Sweeney, who was with us via Skype in the deep blue county of Broward County. What about Maria's point?
Well, you know, why did we get progressive? Because Democrats were afraid of being called liberals. You know, there's a constant sort of vilification of whatever label you want to put on the left. And I think she has kind of a point that, you know, that there is this whatever label you want to put on it, gets, you know, kind of demonized in a way that conservative generally doesn't in the mainstream.
Danny?
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, to contextualize thing, I think it's important to note that, you know, what's considered mainstream Republican today, 10 years ago, would have been considered an extreme. I mean, the party has gone far to the right.
4 years ago, arguably,
right? I mean, it's gone far to the right.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was an op-ed in the Miami New Times that I thought actually was very interesting, where it was asking the question of, does Ron DeSantis get to call Andrew Gillum an extreme when he himself embodies a lot of really the right going far to the right? You know, it's questionable to allow the narrative to be driven by what's considered acceptable on the right when, you know, the right's moved to the right, the left hasn't.
Yeah.
So does that make it extreme?
How is all of this influencing down ticket races here again? I mean, the governor's race is going to soak up a lot of oxygen in the room, no doubt about it. In the media, we will plead guilty probably to, you know, pushing the ideology to the wings of those parties. Certainly that is the case in terms of the number of the positions that the candidates have been articulating. But down ticket, Dan Sweeney, I mean, how does that influence the race in the 22nd congressional district, in the 23rd congressional district in Broward and Palm Beach counties?
You know, I wish I had more data on exactly how no party affiliation voters favor certain sides on any given issue. You know, anecdotally, I feel like, you know, the no party voters that tend to lean Democratic actually tend to be a lot more left than your typical Democratic Party voter, you know, because this Democratic Party in Florida has spent so many years going center and running folks like Alex Sink and like Jim Davis and like Republican turned Democrat Charlie Crist for governor, that it really turns off a lot of that liberal base that eventually say there's not really a home for me here, and you wind up with no party voters. So I think especially among the Democratic Party, you may be kind of surprised at just how many of the no party affiliation voters that lean toward the left tend to actually be a lot more left than a lot of people in the Democratic Party. I don't know if that holds up with the Republicans, but I think it's certainly the case on the one side.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, the last time we did get a good reading on which way the non-party affiliated voters went was in 2016.
Right.
I mean, Trump carried the state.
Right.
He's also...
And he did very well in South Florida, too. He didn't carry South Florida, but he did extremely well.
He did. Yep. Yeah. But you also had, you know, essentially a populist figure in that election at the top of the ticket. He's not a factor directly in this election. So, you know, we don't know.
Those five letters won't be on the ballot, but he will be a factor in
exactly.
The election. Yeah. Sure. Danny Rivero, watching the 27th Congressional District for us and many number of different things, his duties as a WLRN reporter. And Dan Sweeney with us via Skype. Dan, watching politics for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Dan, Danny, thanks for being on the roundup this week. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We got more politics to come, folks. Stick around. Lots to talk about. How two Parkland parents fared in their campaigns to join the Broward School Board and the successful votes to raise taxes for teacher pay in Broward and in the Keys. 800-743-WLRN as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Broward County will be getting at least one new school board member, one parent of a Stoneman Douglas shooting victim. Lori Olideff won the school board seat representing Parkland.
What happened to my daughter on February 14th, it empowered me to want to make change.
A separate race is going into a recount this weekend. That countywide race had incumbent Donna Korn facing two challengers, including Ryan Petty, whose daughter was killed in the Stoneman Douglas shooting. Meantime, voters in Broward and in the Keys okayed paying higher property taxes. In Broward County, the money will go toward teacher pay and school security. In the Keys, the dollars will be to pay for the new state-mandated school security requirements. This is Monroe County School Board Chair Bobby Highsmith.
The new law that came down from the state, we had very clear guidelines, and there's really three areas that we needed to fill. One was the safety and security officers, one was the hardening of the schools, and the third, which to my mind was the most important, is the mental health piece. And so we've been able to fulfill the hardening efforts with our capital funding projects. We've been able to address the mental health issues with the increased state funding. But the school resource officers, school security officers, is one area where we just did not have enough money in the budget to meet those additional requirements.
So did you vote in the school board elections? Did you vote in the property tax referenda in Broward and in the Keys? Another property tax referenda coming up in Miami-Dade County this fall. School security, the youth vote, is that driving your interest in the elections? Maybe you didn't vote, but your taxes will be going up. You okay with that? If you're among the 30% or so of registered voters that cast ballots in the past week, how would you try to convince the other 70% to show up this fall?
Chris Devlin here, Miami, Florida. I did not go to the polls on Tuesday. I'm an unaffiliated voter, so I was left out of the primary process. What would have gotten me to the polls was a different system, and an overarching thing would be a change to the entire system, which would allow unaffiliated voters to vote in the primary of their choice.
800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Amber in Lake Worth sent us this note saying, I voted, but I think it'll take open primaries to get many others to participate. Next hour, we will be covering the results of the gubernatorial primaries and digging in deep with the race that is shaping up between Andrew Gillum as the Democrat and Ron DeSantis on the Republican side. School politics now here on the Florida Roundup. Jessica Bakeman watching education for us here at WLRN. Nancy Klingener is our southernmost reporter in Key West at the studios of Key West. Jessica, first of all, let's tackle the Broward County School Board vote. Is still remaining undecided right now. The vote count is getting a recount in the countywide seat, the open seat that was here. What's the situation?
Right. So this is the race that you mentioned between incumbent Donna Korn and Ryan Petty, whose daughter Elena was killed in the shooting. There was a third candidate, but that person didn't get enough votes to be in the running anymore.
Right.
But basically, there were a bunch of ballots that came in throughout the day on Tuesday, and the election supervisors didn't have a chance to finish counting. And because the incumbent, Donna Korn, her majority was so small, 50.4%, so she was just over 50%, it's triggering a recount. And, you know, it's probably not likely that the final product is different, but Ryan Petty is hoping that Donna Korn's total does fall below 50%, in which case it would trigger a runoff in November. So then they would both be on the ballot in November.
Because Korn's margin of victory, you have to get over 50% to win.
50% plus one vote.
Plus one vote. And because her overage of 50% was only 0.4% of the votes cast, that calls for an automatic recall.
Right.
It's within the ordinance. It's not something of question about ballot quality or anything along those lines. It is, if the margin of victory in this case is less than 0.5%, boom, automatic recall. They'll do it this weekend.
Right. That happens. And then, like I mentioned, there was also this additional wrinkle that there were all these ballots that came in. And so there was actually like a discrepancy between how many votes were cast and how many were actually reported that night when they gave us the rundown of percentages. So it's a little bit up in the air.
Yeah. As an aside, Nan in Key West, same goes for the Key West mayor. Is that right?
They actually did the recount yesterday. So, I mean, on Wednesday.
And the results?
That's all settled. They were the same as were reported on Tuesday night.
All right.
We're going to have a runoff in the mayor's race.
So you'll have a runoff in Key West. Go ahead, Jessica.
One funny thing to note. So, first of all, this gives us some insight as to why the Ryan Petty campaign really hasn't spoken out. They didn't put out a statement conceding or congratulating Donna Korn. So obviously they were anticipating this. But also there was some tweeting last night about the recount, and Ryan Petty tweeted a meme of Jim Carrey from the movie Dumb and Dumber saying, "So you're telling me there's a chance?" Which I thought was really funny.
Finding a little bit of humor in what had been kind of a nasty race in the final weeks of that campaign, right?
Yeah. So a couple different things. You had on Donna Korn's side, she had appeared at an event where she said that last school year was amazing. And it was, I asked her about it actually on election night. I went to her victory party. And she said, you know, it was an off the cuff comment, not prepared, and that she was referring to the academic progress that had been made because she was speaking to principals, but that she has apologized for it, that she says, "I needed to apologize for it. I should have acknowledged the shooting. Clearly, I wasn't talking about that." But that was something that Ryan Petty and other critics had seized on and had circulated. And of course, some of the parents had said that that was really painful for them. And then on the other side, you know, Korn's campaign had leaked or at least, you know, alerted the Sun Sentinel to this history of controversial tweets that Ryan Petty has, mostly from many years ago, where he had a series of tweets that were racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, even pro-gun. And I spoke with at least one voter in Parkland who said she was voting for Lori Alhadeff, but she was voting against Ryan Petty because she is Jewish, and she said she felt very uncomfortable with the idea of electing someone who had tweeted this anti-Semitic idea.
Alhadeff's child was shot and killed in the school shooting. She did win the district seat for the Parkland area to
Parkland,
be represented.
Parkland, Coral Springs, and Tamarack.
To be represented on the school district. What will her presence mean on that school board in Broward County?
You know, I asked her that, and I asked, so at her victory party, I actually was able to go to both on Tuesday night, and it was filled with the other parents of kids who died, and they're these really familiar faces and voices now, you know, Max Schachter, April Shentrup, Fred Guttenberg. And they all said, you know, I think it's really important to have a parent, and a parent who has experienced this so personally, because they're going to be able to add a perspective that no one else really can. And I would imagine for people in Parkland who feel skeptical about the school board right now, at least they'll feel like they have one voice that is going to be critical and is going to push back. I asked Donna Korn about this. So also, like this group of parents at Lori Alhadeff's party, the incumbent school board members were with Donna Korn at her party. And so I talked to a couple of them. And, you know, I asked Rosalind Osgood, who was not on the ballot. Her race was not on the ballot this time around.
A city board member in Broward County. Right,
right. Right.
And not up for re-election.
Right. And she's a big supporter of Superintendent Robert Runcie. Yep. And, of course, that's what a lot of people saw was at stake in this election. And she said, you know, I asked her, what do you think about Lori Alhadeff? And she just said, you know, I just don't know her. So we'll see. But I asked her, and I asked Donna Korn, you know, these people in Parkland, I talked to several people who said, I just want to see the school board wiped clean. Let's get rid of all of them. Let's have all new people. And I said to the sitting school board members, like, what are you going to do to win back this constituency of people?
Right.
And Donna Korn's answer was, you know, it's an imperative that we are listening to them. But Rosalind Osgood said, well, we have to correct a lot of the misinformation that's out there.
Well, and what's interesting, right, in that feeling maybe of some of the voters that you spoke to that wanted to start with a clean slate, that is how they feel, but yet the
that's
majority of voters, that wasn't reflected in the referendum question, which, you know, was about money and their willingness to spend more in property taxes to send that to the school district most of it earmarked for teacher salaries and for school security measures.
Right. And I mean, it wasn't reflected across the board because Lori Alhadeff's race, there was no incumbent. The incumbent had moved out.
Right.
And the other four races that were on the ballot, either an incumbent won or an incumbent is headed for a runoff or a recount, but they're all still in the game. So it looks like the likely, you know, scenario is we end up with four of the five people returning.
Yeah. When we were talking about the recount earlier, I may have said recall. I apologize if I did. I meant recount of the not a recall election. It was a recount of the results that have been triggered automatically in Broward County in that countywide race. Nan Klingener, what about the referenda in Monroe County when it came to property taxes? Unlike Broward County, there's not a teacher salary portion to the higher taxes for schools in Monroe County that was approved. It is all school security.
It is, and it's a relatively small amount in addition to the other school taxes. It'll be $6.25 for every $100,000 in property value. So it wasn't a huge ask on their part, but they want to be able to raise up to about $1.8 million to help pay for all the additional security measures. And I just want to make a little southernmost brag here. Monroe County had a 47% turnout on Tuesday.
Wow. Yeah. Some of the highest in the state right there.
Yeah, and we have a lot of no-party affiliated voters. It's 28% of our registered voters are no-party affiliated. But we also had a mayor's race that got a lot of attention.
Yep.
So
go ahead, Jessica.
I just had a thought about the tax increases, because obviously that was on the ballot for Broward and Monroe. And in November, we'll have one for Miami-Dade and Palm Beach. And at least some of those were already considering doing that before the shooting happened, because they wanted an opportunity to raise revenue for teacher salaries, which is something that the legislature is not so happy about. They've actually gone to great extent in recent years to pass things to try to limit the power of local municipalities, especially to raise taxes. So I think it's kind of interesting that they passed this law after Parkland that has all of these new safety requirements, and then they basically gave a pretty good excuse to maybe every district, if they wanted to raise taxes, because they're saying, well, we can't afford to hire the police officers otherwise.
Yeah, one of the other referendum that'll be on the November ballot is also a referendum asking homeowners to increase the homeowners' homestead property exemption as well, to take more of those dollars out of the tax rolls. Your phone calls here on property taxes, school board election, 800-743-9576. Dania Beach, Lewis on line one. Thanks for your patience, Lewis. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Thanks for having me. I was just calling to say I voted on Tuesday against the measure to increase the taxes, just because I think it's a very wrong business that NRA and weapons company have, that give as many weapons to as many people as we can, hoping that somebody with mental health issues creates a shooting. Then we use taxpayers' money to buy more guns to protect the public. And I agree that we need more money towards mental health issues, but this school protection, I think, is not what we should be focusing our money on.
So I think Lewis is saying that, you know, some of this money is potentially going to be going to buy more guns, because we're seeing districts hire armed security guards.
School
like in Broward,
officers and others,
and in Broward, it's a combination, because they're using armed staff in addition to certified law enforcement. And that has been one of the criticisms of this policy push nationwide, that, you know, the idea of arming teachers or arming staff is something that the NRA has wanted for a long time, because it would create a new source of government revenue.
And Nan, in the Keys, where this referendum was focused on school security, how were the positions staked out? To Lewis's point, in Dania Beach and Broward County, you know, did the school district address these dollars potentially going to firearms for school resource officers?
Well, they are only going with police officers, you know, actual Monroe County Sheriff's deputies and Key West Police Department officers in the schools. Monroe basically wanted nothing to do with that Guardian program that would be arming staff, and are hoping to get some money left over from that program to help pay for this. So basically, I guess if you could say there's more police officers on the job, there would be more weapons, but they are not arming other school staff or officer security people.
Certainly, the school district tax referenda in Monroe County and Broward County, as well as the school district races in Broward County, did attract a lot more of attention than normally it does because of the Marjorie Stoneman tragedy. Janelle in Hillsborough Shores has a point she wants to make. Go ahead, Janelle. You're on the radio, and thanks for holding. Janelle, you still with us in Hillsborough?
Tom, I
think her quick question was about the youth vote here. And while we don't have necessarily the demographic breakout about who voted early and the absentee and the primary, we did see an increase in youth voter registration prior to this election. Jessica, your point.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to what Nan was saying, that there is an ongoing, still unresolved question about this funding regarding the Guardian program, mm-hmm. which is the arming staff, because so there was $67 million in the budget for it, but a lot of school districts didn't want to participate. And so that left about $58 million that hasn't been spent. And Governor Rick Scott, who obviously is running for U.S. Senate and is probably looking to be a little bit more centrist than he has been, it has come out and said the legislature should redirect that money to let school districts use it for other school security needs. And so far, the incoming leaders of the state legislature have said, no, they don't want to do that. Yeah. So there's already some friction, you know, with if you don't want to spend the money the way we wanted you to, then you're not going to get to spend it at all, I think is the message.
It will come back certainly in this general election for state House races and state Senate races as well.
And next session for sure.
Absolutely, which is not an election year session. So it's in the springtime this time around.
Right,
Jessica
March.
Bakeman, watching education for us here at WLR, and Nancy Klingener, our southernmost reporter, with us in Key West at the studios of Key West. Nan and Jessica, thanks so much for joining us on the roundup again this week.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
A little more politics to come here. Voters, okay, two measures opening the way for some big redevelopments of marquee properties in their cities. 800-743-WLRN. Real estate and politics is next on the roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. Politicians and property taxes weren't the only questions on some ballots this primary season. So were parrots and a shopping mall. Voters in Miami and South Miami approved ballot questions, opening the way for the redevelopments of two high-profile properties. In Miami, it's a 13-story hotel that could be going to what used to be called Parrot Jungle, now Jungle Island. In South Miami, it's a rule change that could mean big changes at the shops at Sunset Mall. Real estate and politics now here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. Next hour, we're going to be diving in deeply into the gubernatorial primaries and the results and the fight for the middle, the non-party affiliated voter in Florida. Join us then. That'll be next hour. Brian Bandel is back with us here on the Florida Roundup, a return trip for him. He writes about real estate and all things financial for the South Florida Business Journal. Kira Gurney also back with us from our partner, the Miami Herald. Kira following politics and all things Miami Beach. She's with us from our studios inside the Miami Herald in Doral. So, Brian, let's start with Jungle Island. What did Miami voters okay on Tuesday?
Miami voters approved the ballot measure to expand the lease with Jungle Island and to allow them to build a hotel. So what's currently the big parking garage in Jungle Island, they will be allowed to build a hotel up to 300 rooms, most likely a child kind of family-friendly hotel.
Not quite an amusement park type situation, but something more outward looking for tourism than currently is the case, right?
Well, keep in mind, Watson Island is right across from Port Miami. So this would be the closest hotel to the cruise port.
Hmm.
So you could have people come in for a cruise, stay in that hotel, maybe go to Jungle Island during the day, and then get on the cruise very easily.
Just a short tunnel ride away from Port Miami, as you mentioned. Kira Gurney, Brian mentioned Watson Island. I know this wasn't on the ballot for Miami Beach voters, but boy, Watson Island right between the mainland and Miami Beach on the causeway. A 300-room hotel, 13-story hotel, between South Beach and Wynwood. What about Miami Beach input on this?
I haven't heard a lot regarding that, but I do think that anything that's going to cause more traffic on the causeway is going to be a big issue for Miami Beach voters. They're currently really upset about some construction that's going on that has led to some lane closures and some serious delays in that area.
Brian, what does the city of Miami get if this hotel is built?
Well, the city of Miami gets $1.2 million a year, or the greater of 5% of the revenue of the hotel, whichever is bigger in a given year.
Is that a good deal?
That's a pretty decent deal. 5% is pretty standard when it comes to the revenue we get from a project like this. And the good thing is, because it's a percentage, if the hotel does a lot better than they think, you'll get the share in that.
What do you think this portends for the other big real estate question that's going to be on the November ballot for City of Miami voters? The soccer stadium.
Yeah, the Beckham Stadium.
Yeah.
I think this is a little bit of a different issue. I think it's less controversial because you're not replacing anything, really. You're not replacing – in Beckham, you're replacing a golf course, and you have people who use the golf course and who are supporters, and they're going to – they have their issues with it.
Yeah.
And then you have soccer fans. So part of the vote's about that. Here, it's not – you're not really replacing anything. You have a parking garage.
You know, parking lot fans aren't going to say, we still need the parking garage.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't think there was a giant organized group against it. So, you know, there's the group that doesn't want more traffic, but, you know, you're going to get that for the Beckham group too.
Real estate and politics were on the ballot, Kira, in Miami Beach. The referendum remaking the membership of the city's Board of Adjustment. This is one of those boards that voters aren't exactly aware of yet, but can exert significant influence. Describe quickly what the BOA does on the beach.
So the Board of Adjustment is a 7-member land use board, and residents and businesses can go before the board if they're asking the city to make an exception regarding some construction rule or regarding the rules around alcohol sales.
Mm-hmm.
And before this election, you had to belong to a certain professional group to be able to serve on the board. So they had a member who was a lawyer, for example, an architect, an engineer. But it was a little bit difficult for the city to fill all 7 of those seats, because if you served on that board, you also couldn't have business before the city's other land board. So if you're an architect, for example, it's going to be a problem for you with your clients if you can't, you know, represent them before the other land use boards. So basically what they did was just allow 2 of the members to be citizens at large, anybody regardless of their profession.
So they don't have to have experience with land use or any kind of real estate or financial expertise.
Exactly.
The other ballot question real significant and direct money question. It was whether or not Miami Beach voters wanted to pay their mayor and their commissioners more money.
Right. And I thought this was a really interesting question, because it kind of goes back to, you know, what do you want your commission to look like in terms of how much they reflect the population of the city you live in? And the proponents of raising the salaries were arguing that if you pay commissioners more, you're going to enable more lower income or middle income people to be able to actually run for the commission. Because as it stands, they make about $6,000 a year in addition to some other benefits. So, you know, some commissioners argue that it's pretty hard to balance your full-time job and all of your commission obligations, and that they would prefer to be paid so that this could be their full-time job.
Right. This is a commissioner pay at $6,000 a year to have a vote on a $300 million-plus city budget.
Exactly.
And voters said no. Six grand a year to serve on the commission is fine.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. And you did have a lot of people say, you know what, I think this money that would have gone towards these raises would be better spent elsewhere. You also had some people, including people on the commission, who just felt like, you know, Miami Beach this year is dealing with property tax revenue that wasn't as high as they were expecting. So they thought maybe this wasn't the year to make a big change for salaries.
One final real estate play on the ballot in South Miami, Brian, changing the number of votes needed to change the city's land use code. Now, that sounds like it was a very general kind of question, but this is really directed at one potential redevelopment.
Yes, the Shops at Sunset Place was not named on the ballot, but this was what it's about. Commissioners previously voted against redeveloping that project, but it had to be a unanimous approval. So now the owners of that property can go forward with a plan to build apartments there, to build a hotel there, and expand the office space to revitalize a mall that's been struggling for almost over a decade.
There's still a few steps before it gets there, though. This changed the rules on the number of votes needed for changes to the land use. So now it has to come back to a reconstituted in this reconstituted land code.
Yeah.
A reconstituted city charter in terms of votes on the land code.
Absolutely. This changes the way the process works, but it still has to go through the city process. They still have to vote on it. It's not a slam dunk that the commissioners will approve it. You know, obviously it'll cause a lot of traffic, you know, extra traffic. There'll be more people living there, but the mall isn't exactly working great today. It's kind of struggling in the way it was configured. I think it had a lot of design problems the way it was built.
Real estate and politics this primary election season. Brian Bandel writing about real estate for the South Florida Business Journal. Kara Gurney watching the city of Miami Beach with our partner, the Miami Herald. Brian, Kara, thanks so much for coming back on to the Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the Roundup this week, this primary week. The program is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Theresa Frontado is our digital director. WLRN's news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Meritz, and WLRN's director of radio programming and our technical supervisor on the Florida Roundup is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, thanks for tweeting, thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting public radio.